Possession crucial from this. How much longer will the referee allow? Dublin lead by a point. And there's the whistle. It's over. It's over.
We earned it by winning the last two matches on the road, and that's not going to be taken away from us.
But what I love in hurling, I love players that never give in.
He hits it. He hits it. It's over the bar.
Hello and welcome to the RTGA podcast. I'm Mikey Stafford. I am joined, as usual, by Rory O'Neill, series producer of The Sunday Game. And we welcome our guests this week, Adrian Russell, editor of the42.ie and the author of a new book about Cork hurling and football called The Double. It relates to some matches they won a couple of years ago. He'll fill us in on that later. Rory's very excited to talk about it. This is our second Cork heavy podcast. We're not talking about Cork again to the rest of the year, Rory. This is it. You've had your quota. But, let's move swiftly on to Cork, because the Connacht and Munster provincial draws were made this morning on Morning Ireland. And for the first time in quite a few years, Kerry will face Cork at the semi-final stage of the Munster Senior Football Championship. This is exciting, lads. Yeah,
I think it is. I think it's a fantastic draw. It's a fantastic draw for Clare and Tipperary. Now, that's not to discount Limerick and Waterford straight off the bat, and I'm sure Limerick will have plenty to say about that, considering they knocked Tipperary out of the Munster Championship this year. But I think it's a brilliant draw for both of those teams, because it gives them the opportunity to get one step closer. I mean, one of those teams is effectively going to be one hurdle away. Irregardless of what happens in the Munster final, one of those teams is one hurdle away from a Super 8s. So that's a huge added incentive both for Colm Collins and for Tipperary as well. So I think it's a good draw. One small little addendum that I would pencil in this year, obviously we would have had, and we shipped a fair bit of criticism for it in relation to our supposed obsession with hurling in terms of match picks. But obviously with two Munster football championships now more or less slated for being on TV, because you would imagine Cork and Kerry will be on television live and the Munster final, it will have an effect on, you know, on the hurling side of it, and that's not necessarily a bad thing either.
From a Cork and Kerry perspective, I'm trying to work out on the way out. It must be like 25 years since Cork won below. I know it's been a few draws. Like,
I have a feeling that I think it's going to come back. I think
because of the OS one, basically.
Yeah, I think it's going to be Páirc Cuíve again. Now I stand to be corrected on that. I think it's three or possibly four on the back of the stadium redevelopment. So the game will probably
be Páirc. Let's see how the pitch gets through the winter before we go. But obviously, Adrian, your book deals, for a large part, well, in the football part, there's the Cork-Meath rivalry kind of takes centre stage. Yeah. But in the early stages, it's Cork-Kerry. And that Cork team overcame the most dominant Kerry team of all time. Yeah. So it can be done, because we're not talking about the most dominant Kerry team of all time now.
No, and I think, you know, Kerry have obviously won the last couple of years, but they've been entertaining games for the most part, and Cork are a coming team. Cork football is on the up, I suppose, if you look at various metrics underage or whatever. And, you know, bringing it back to the book, as you say, like in 87, kind of after the draw in Páirc Cuíve and then going down to Killarney, that was the making of that team, really, and got them up and running for that period of time. So, you know, whatever the game is, like, this will be a good test for the team, I suppose. I think it's a great draw. It's really exciting. Like, I mean, sometimes it's hard to get up for these to you know, imagine yourself next summer kind of at these games, but yeah, this is really exciting, I have to say.
There you go, folks. If you're feeling in any way jaded with the provincial championships, the cure for it is to spend months of your life writing a book that celebrates the Munster Hurling and Football Championship, and you will come around to loving it again. Further north, Roscommon and Mayo could collide in the semi-final, which is the GAA speak for Galway. Have got the handy draw in Connacht this year. They have to go to New York and for a few days win that, come back and play Sligo, who I believe did not win a match in 2019. Mm. Beat Sligo, and you're same as the teams in Munster, you're one hurdle away from the Super 8. Mm. So all they need now is a manager.
And you'd hope there'd be white smoke on that front over the next couple of weeks, and there are some big names in there. I know Liam Kearns has been mentioned, and he'd be a fantastic appointment, no doubt, considering the success that he has had with Laois and Kerry over the last couple of years. But one interesting thing on Sligo, in the build-up to the championship this year, they actually staged a challenge game in my club here in Dublin. and played down. You more or less could probably describe it as a behind closed doors game, because there was literally nobody there bar a few club members and obviously the two teams. And I was impressed with Sligo. I think the thing with Sligo is, like, and this was very noticeable when you actually saw them up close and personal, how really young. I'm talking very, very young. And I think those players, obviously, you know, they didn't have the greatest of seasons in the year just gone. I think they'll mature a little bit better. I think they've got a good manager there in Paul Taylor. And I think they will, you know, I wouldn't necessarily see that as a complete foregone conclusion. But, you know, look, it's very far ahead anyway.
If they all come back, it'll show a sign of character, because, you know, to have a duck egg of a year in intercounty football is unusual and can't be easy for young players. Yesterday, we had the Leinster draw. So we now know how Dublin are going to win the 2020 Leinster Football Championship. But there were some, you know, you can't make a silk purse out of a pig's ear, but at the same time, you can say that there's a couple of interesting ties that will make. First of all, they've decided against drawing the semi-finals until after quarterfinals are played. So no team is doomed to play Dublin in a semi-final yet. Somebody will be doomed during the summer.
That was a wise move, I think.
It's deck chairs and the Titanic kind
possibly,
of stuff.
Possibly.
But we have my own county, Wexford, and Paul Galvin. Their first championship outing will be against Wicklow. So that's not a bad opening championship match to have. If you're the Wexford manager, perhaps the new Wicklow manager would argue otherwise. You've got Carlow v Offaly, Louth v Longford. The winners of Wexford-Wicklow will play Meath. The winners of Louth Longford will play Laois. The winners of Carlow and Offaly play Kildare, and Westmeath, the lucky added bonus of being drawn straight into a quarter final against Dublin. So, Rory, you're kind of interested to see how Paul Galvin goes, aren't you?
Well, I think there's a huge Kerry influence on the Leinster Championship across the board. Between Jack O'Connor in Kildare, you have Mike Quirk obviously going into Laois, and now you've Paul Galvin going into Wexford. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how all three, you know, look to try and change the fortunes of each of those three counties. I think Wexford probably have the biggest scope for improvement, because they obviously didn't have a very good 2019. So you would imagine if, you know, like they should look to try. I mean, that's a fabulous draw for them in one sense. I think this year, the Leinster Championship, if you actually, again, I know it's a terrible proviso to add into any situation, but if you do take Dublin out of it, the Leinster Championship was actually a fairly good championship. You know, like it there were some very competitive games. There was a fantastic, I think, quarter final which went to a replay between Longford and Kildare, and there was a couple of other near runs. I think Offaly might have taken Meath to the pin of their collar. Like, so it's just a pity that you do have this behemoth kind of station in that particular provincial championship. But I mean, look, that's what it is.
There's not much of it. Adrian, we talk about the provincial championships nearly every week on this podcast. It'd be unfair not to give you your speak on it. Where do you stand?
I think it's kind of on the way out, isn't it? I think we're just living through the last of it, really. Like, I can't see how reform isn't coming, essentially. But one element and one layer, I suppose, to this year, like, for example, the Cork and Kerry, not to bring it back, but the Tier 2 proposals, which may or may not get in, I suppose. I suppose that adds another kind of element of jeopardy to the likes of Cork and Kerry. So, for example, if Cork lose and if particular proposals get through, then they'll be, you know, in a B championship. And I presume that, you know, there's a lot of that element of people thinking, you know, in the other championships as well. So that adds something interesting. We don't know how that's going to affect it yet. But anyway, to answer your question, though, I think, well, maybe we'll touch on it later with finance as well. I think that there's a root and branch kind of upheaval really needed to really put a structure on the way we kind of approach our games and organise our counties to make it sustainable, is my thinking.
On the other, you mentioned the Kerry influence, you only mentioned Paul Galvin. We obviously got Jack O'Connor in with Kildare, and then Mike Quirk has taken over at Laois. We were just chatting about Mike Quirk had a pretty tough defeat with Kieran O'Reilly's there in the Kerry Championship, didn't they?
Always very difficult, though, for club teams coming up against divisional teams, and then to throw into the mix in terms of East Kerry when you have the likes of David Clifford and Stephen O'Brien up front. You know, it's, in fairness to Cairns O'Rahillies, I think, look, they're as strong as any club that you would imagine out there. But I'm just reading reports. I haven't actually seen any video, but from reading reports on it, apparently each goal, like, you know, they just they weren't able to kind of kick on, and they had a, obviously, as you were saying, they had a big lead. But yeah, it's a pity for them. But I suppose, look, that's the nature of divisional teams when they're in. When they're in these county championships, they do, you know, they just have that extra bit of firepower up front.
Okay, that's quite enough about the provincial championships until we come back to moan at you next year, Rory, about what games aren't on the television.
Yeah.
Right, I'm very happy to say we have Willie Maher on the phone, the Coola senior hurling manager who saw his side reach in his first season, another Dublin senior final. They beat St. Vincent's 321-116. In the final, they will play St. Bridget's, who overcame Craig Kieran 217-113. So, Willie, you had big shoes to fill there, and you can't have done any more than you've done thus far. So, how would you assess your summer?
It's been very good. First of all, I was delighted to get the opportunity to manage Coola. They're a fantastic club, fantastic group of people. We're in the county final. We won the league, that's about 3 weeks ago. And, things have been very, very good so far.
You will be favourites going into this final. You've already beaten Jude's twice. You beat them 222-16 in the league in June without a lot of your county stars, and then you beat them 227-016 in the championship in April. That probably seems like a long time ago, but at the same time, most people looking in would imagine that you have their number.
Yeah, well, look, I suppose, look, with Pez, we played with a very tough match on Sunday against Vincent's. Really, really good team. Vincent's missed a lot of chances, and it could have been, I think, the 11-point gap kind of flattered us. So I suppose that was the first part of that. Yeah, we've played Bridget's in the league, we've played them in the championship and beat them both times, but I think they've significantly improved, as you can see from their run. They've won a good quarter final, they won a good semi-final Sunday, and I was just looking at the tapes of them last night. They're a very, very good team with a lot of very athletic players, so we'll be under pressure.
You're already looking at the tapes, good man. You're keeping busy. They haven't been in a final in a good few years. It's a sign of a pretty vibrant championship. Are you surprised at the level that you've been witnessing in Dublin?
It's something I would have been looking at from afar over the last couple of years with Coola, Kilmacud, the bigger name teams, Ballyboden winning it last year. But I think the overall standard in the championship is very, very high. I think the league kind of showed us that as regards the league in Dublin is very, very important, and we were playing good teams kind of every 2 weeks, and it gives you a sample of the work that's gone on in Dublin over the last couple of years, the players that are coming through, and look, we played very well against Crokes 2 weeks ago and beat them very well, but that doesn't always happen, and those matches have been very tight over the last couple of years. So between Crokes, Bridget's, Bowden, Lucan, Jude's, there's a lot of really, really good teams in Dublin, and yeah, I suppose pleasantly surprised that it's very, very competitive, and that's what you want.
Yeah, looking at some of the totals you racked up, 321 against Vincent's, you got 318 against Crokes, 326 against Bridget's, 27 points against Ballantyre, but goals seem to be a key part of your game. And I was watching an interview you did after the semi-final, and you said when the pitches get heavy, scores become a little bit harder to come by. Goals are key.
Yeah, no, I think so. Like, we all watch a lot of county championship this time of the year, wherever the county is, and there, a lot of them are invariably the same. Goals are big scores in particularly heavy conditions. As is a good free taker, who you want hitting your nine shots out of 10 or 10 out of 10. So I think, look, the sport changes from what we've looked at during the summer on really, I suppose, fast pitches in the inter-county game where the skill levels have gone through the roof. But club hurling is, scores and goals are very, very important. And I think it's probably not something we overly concentrate on. We just concentrate on, I suppose, playing the game, and then when the chances arrive, you want to take them. But I think it's they're very, very important this time of the year.
You mentioned free takers. David Tracy, he got 1 point from a free there at the weekend, and the rest of your scores came from play, as far as I could see. That's pretty impressive total to rack up when only one score is coming from free, and it would also suggest credit to the St. Vincent's defence. They must have been pretty well behaved.
Or well, the referee wasn't giving us any free. But I think it's probably somewhere in the middle. I suppose one free in the entire hour of a scoreable is a bit bizarre, particularly in these this time of the year. Similarly, in our semi-final, we didn't get a whole lot of frees, and in the league matches. So, I suppose it's a very, very important part of it, and I think probably a county final will come down to that. Paul Winters is a fantastic free taker for Bridget's, who doesn't seem to miss. And, it's an important part of of preparation and making sure your free taker hits his balls over the bar.
Yeah, so goals are important, scores from play are important, so it must be nice to have Conor Callaghan back in the team, is it?
Yeah, like, look, Conor's great. I think it's probably fairly well heard at this stage across the summer with Dublin Footballers and what he did last Sunday and the Sunday before with us. But look, Conor's is a phenomenal player. He's a great fella, and I suppose he's just trying to manage his workload over the last couple of weeks and into the future now, because they're playing senior football next weekend. And it's just, you know, he's wanted everywhere because he's a very talented guy.
Yeah, we'll come back to balancing dual players in a minute, but I'm sorry, I'm fascinated by Conor Callaghan in a week after an All Ireland final replay. I'm sure he went out with his teammates and celebrated an historic victory. I really want to know about, did he turn up for a training session? Was it the first time he'd held a hurl in a couple of months? And what did he do with training?
Yeah, he didn't do a whole lot, you know. But yeah, he was there. He's always there, and we need him and want him. And I suppose you're just kind of trusting him and the talent that he has, and the guy who he is. I assume he was being poking around for the summer, even with brothers or friends. But no, the level of training was very, very little. And it's a fascinating situation to go play so well against your local rivals in Crokes a week after the All-Ireland football final. But just that testament to the fella that Conn is, like, you know.
Yeah, you're selling him a little bit short. He played well, but he scored two goals in the first 7 minutes in his first hurling match of the summer, probably since the spring. I don't even know if he played during the spring. Was it the first game of hurling?
He played in April with us. The matches against Jude and Bridget Sam was very, very good in both of those matches as well. But he is, I suppose it's very difficult to explain, but that's the type of player that he is. And again, you see him during the summer with the footballers, just a really, really honest, talented player who gets the most out of himself, and that's who Conn is.
Yeah, you'd feel for your predecessor in the job there, Matty Kenny. He's looking at these performances and he knows that unless there's a massive change of heart from Conn himself, he won't have him with the Dublin Hurlers next year. And it must be very frustrating to know that there's a hurler of that calibre in the county and he's not available to you.
Possibly, yeah. I suppose I haven't spoken to Matty about it, but it's something that all teams want someone like him, because he's a very, very talented hurler. But that's just the way it is, and I think it's a case of saying what you have and moving forward, and I'm sure Matty will do that in 2020.
Willie, Rory O'Neill here, how are you doing?
Willie, I'd
be very curious to get your take. Obviously Tipperary are the standard bearers at the minute, being current All-Ireland champions, so I'd just be very curious to get your take on, you know, firstly, your appraisal of the standard of club hurling in Dublin, and then maybe to compare that, and what would you see as the big difference between the standard in Dublin and the standard, we'll say, in Tipperary, which you would also know?
Yeah, I suppose you just take it. Look, first of all, Dublin, I think the standard is high. The top teams are a match for anybody. I suppose Tipperary is an unusual example because we have a huge amount of senior teams, and I think it's 32 at the moment, so there's a range in standard, or a range in classes within that senior as regards 32 teams. So, and hence we haven't done one in the Club All Ireland since 86. So I think there's a bit there. The standard is high. As I said, the league is taken very, very seriously, which will be a big difference in Dublin and Tipperary. Not that it's not taken seriously in Tipperary, but just ultimately the games are very, very competitive this year for us. We're winning matches by a point, albeit without a couple of good few of our county boys during the summer. But it's a very, very decent standard. And I think, look, we'll say you see Ballyboden going to the Leinster Club final, beaten by Ballyhale last year. Like, that's, Ballyhale are probably, you know, the greatest club team ever, having won 7 All-Irelands. And, you know, Ballyboden were, not that they were well beaten in the end, but they were there, they were competing. And I suppose Coolah's exploits over the last 2 or 3 years have won 2 All-Irelands against, good teams as well. So I think the standard in Dublin is very, very high. And, I think it's great. It's very competitive. It's great.
You come from a parish of Ballingarry, which is not a big place in South Tipperary. Your previous managerial experience is all at county level, underage with the minors and Tipperary under 21s. You're assistant to Terry McGrath in Waterford. I'm just wondering if you could give us an idea, coming from where you came from in your own playing career and Ballingarry, the scale of Coolah as a club and kind of the organisational operation that's required to kind of get pitches for training to, you know, make sure everybody's where they need to be, and, you know, obviously balancing all that with the dual player aspect.
Yeah, it's something that's kind of very unusual. Like it's a very small community, if you believe that. I would say the hurling and football club in Coola. The pitches piece is massive because we have a few pitches in South Dublin that we use: Shankill, Thomastown, Hyde Road, Hyde Park, and we train in Bray an awful lot of the time. So yeah, organising pitches is something I suppose is very different for me because. I said I come from Ballingarry. We have our own fields, as do most other clubs in the country. Coola in South Dublin, where it is, it's difficult to get that ground. I know they're working hard on trying to achieve that, but it's certainly something very, very different. On the dual piece, it's again, I suppose having experience in 2012, we won the Minor All-Ireland Tipperary. We had 13 dual players that year, and Tipperary won the Munster Football Championship that year in Minor. So it was a very, very, I suppose, difficult balancing act. I see David Powers, the new Tipperary senior football manager, myself and David worked very, very well at that time as minor managers, trying to, I suppose, interact with each other and make sure that the best was got out of both panels. It's a difficult situation. There's no perfect situation where you're managing dual players. I think it's on a person-to-person basis. But no, a very, very difficult situation. Just needs constant communication.
Yeah. Well, you might just give people a little bit of your own background. You've been a coach and a manager for quite a long time now. You were the 1996 All-Ireland minor winning captain with Tipperary. You played with Kieran's. You played a little bit of under 21 and senior before your career was ended in 2002. Could you just tell us a little bit about how your career came to an end?
Yeah, no, I got injured and at 22. So that was my career over very, very quickly, which I suppose allowed me to concentrate on coaching as a way of filling the void that playing would have been or had been for my years. But I suppose when injury comes at a young age, you realise that it's very, very, you enjoy, I suppose, when you're hurling, and something I quite try to instill with a lot of the players that I do get involved with, to enjoy what they do, to be free in what they do. And hurling with the club or county or whoever it is, the college, is a very, very enjoyable experience. And I think that's central to what's my mantra as a manager, that we enjoy what we do because this is a pleasure to play hurling.
Yeah. Last summer, last August, you were being discussed as favourite for the Tipperary senior manager before the return of Liam Sheedy kind of came out of left field. Was that a position you felt you were ready to take last summer if it had gone another way?
Yeah, like we're all, I suppose, Tipperary's a hurling mad place. I'm a hurling mad person, and I think everybody in Tipperary with an interest or a following of Tipperary hurling wants to a crack at that job because that's I've been going to Tipperary matches since I was a young boy and my father, and that's central to the person that I am now. And look, I'd love the opportunity if it came down the line, and it'll be a huge honour. And it's Tipperary, it's where I'm from, and that's it.
Yeah, you were done out of the job, shall we say, for want of a more elegant term, by a man who'd won an All-Ireland, a legend in the county, and I suppose. You've no need to do too much navel-gazing on what happened there, but do you think, having had most of your own managerial experience at underage grades, do you think a stint with a senior club of the scale of Coola will only help you the next time you apply for an inter-county manager job?
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. I suppose I have managed my own for Ballingarry at home as well, which would be the other end of the scale, trying to avoid relegation and win South Championships in Tipperary. My wife's club, Faith Harriers in Wexford Town, I was involved with them last year for a summer and I really, really enjoyed it. Coola, yes, is a different level of club, but ultimately it's the same game. It's a relatively simple game. You're looking for the same characteristics. Yes, we're winning matches well at the moment and Coola have been hugely successful, but it's fundamentally the same thing. It's a huge experience, I suppose, working with quality players at adult level. And yeah, it's probably it's filled in a few gaps, and I suppose in my experience, and I'm delighted to be involved with them.
Yeah. So just before we let you go, kind of fill us in now on the time scale. What kind of training will you do now ahead of the final, and what's the schedule looking like?
Yeah, the schedule will be, it's a football week this week in Dublin, so that's something else to contend with. We have two guys playing on Sunday, Con being one of them, and Colm Shannon. So it's a case of managing that. They went to the 40-foot last night for a recovery session. And we'll train Wednesday, Friday, Sunday, and then the following week will probably be Wednesday, Friday. But again, it's not the we're not going to go on mass training or anything. It's literally maybe have a good run out next Sunday morning, and that'll be it. Get ready and taper down and get ready for Bridget's because, as I said, they're they're a very decent outfit, and we'll have to be on our game to match them.
Okay, well, Willie, thanks very much for joining us, and best of luck in the final.
Thanks very much for the conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Good luck, Willie.
Willie Maher, not a man to rest on his laurels, done out of the job with his native county, and he just gets right back on the horse in the job that obviously it puts you in the shop window for an inter-county job. And he made no bones about it. He's an ambitious guy, and he wants to manage a senior inter-county team by the sounds of things, Adrian.
Yeah, I don't think there's much difference these days really in organising a group as good and a club as big as Coola, and then making a step up. Sounds like he's ready to go whenever he gets that nod.
Rory, people would be wrong to think every club in Dublin is like Coola, but there's a few of them. Bowden, Vincent's, Coola, Kilmacud, they're just massive operations, aren't they?
Huge, absolutely, just extraordinary. I mean, I think for a lot of those clubs like Kilmacud, Bowden, all those, I think they're big businesses, you know, and they require a huge level of voluntary work. I'm sure there's plenty. There's probably a few people even in there, and administration roles, just fully paid positions, because there's no way those clubs could operate otherwise. I mean, I think Kilmacud are approaching something like 3,000 members. I think Coola are somewhere similar. I mean, if you think about that, 3,000. I mean, how many teams? You're talking over 110, 120 teams, in terms of managements for all of those, fundraising. You know, like trying to, you know, pay your county board fees, all like it's your public liability, finding pitches to play. It's extraordinary, really. I don't know how those. There's an argument even possibly some of those clubs are too big and maybe should be split. Now, I know that one might not necessarily go down too well with some of those clubs, but I often wonder. Like the concept of a GA club to me is that you should really know pretty much everybody in the club, or certainly, if you know, 60-70% of everybody. That's the idea, I would assume. Like I would imagine there's people that probably go through their whole lives in some of those clubs and might necessarily know half the people that are also in the club as well. So they're that big at this stage. And, you know, maybe that's part of the overall strategic plan that the GA themselves might have to look at long term, that, you know, these massive super clubs, are they the way forward? You know, that's definitely something for debate.
Speaking of admin, finances and stuff like that, we had one of the more unusual GA stories break late last week after the after our last podcast, which was Pat McDonough, Supermax founder, sponsor of Galway GA for considerable amount of time, came out and pretty much demanded to know where the money had gone. It was an interesting statement and unprecedented, you would almost say, certainly from a frontline sponsor. Interesting to get your views on it. I'd just like to note that we're in the office, we were big fans of the fact that there was a link at the bottom of the statement.
Get your chili cheese fries as well as read the statement. Yeah,
like. you don't get to topple Supermax in, you know, the European trademark court or copyright law case without being quite a savvy businessman. And look, we've all been talking about Pat McDonough. There's been pictures of Supermax logos all over our websites for the last week. But Adrian, this is a funny story in a way, but it says a lot about where the GA is at the moment, I think, in terms of how teams are being funded, how much money has been spent on inter-county teams. You had the benefactor in Mayo also coming out last week, Tim O'Leary, or the week before last, kind of saying, you know, similarly, where's the money going? As you say, these are big businesses, this is a big administration. What's your view? Should sponsors know where money is going?
I think almost, like, everybody should know where the money goes. I think that's fair enough to ask what is done with this money. Like Pat McDonough is obviously a massive stakeholder, and he laid out very clearly how much they've invested in Galway GA over the years. That's admirable. But I mean, fans and club people, their stakeholders, you know, if you take the thesis of the GA to its logical conclusion. So I think everybody almost should know where this money is coming from, where it's going. And then it's probably, you know, kind of on a macro level again, like, it's all very kind of willy-nilly, isn't it? Like, kind of where the money is coming from. I was on a panel with Tomás O'Shea the weekend, and he was making a point, you know, it's very fickle. You know, someone backs Tipperary 1 year and they, you know, which is great. Like, but like then the resources are on an upward turn on the graph, and then the next year they mightn't have that. And the same in Kerry, with, you know, centres of excellence are, you know, funded in different ways. You know, so like it would be great if there was some kind of system and a centralised cap almost without
NFL style.
Yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, there's a lot wrong with the NFL, but they do a lot in a very socialist fair way as well, I suppose, like, ironically enough. But so there's lessons there, and you know, it probably like feeds into all these conversations we have and debates we have about Dublin GA and where that money comes and goes from as well. So I think there's a big there's a big debate to be had, really. I don't know how that's solved.
Rory, the Colm Keyes in the Indo, he does a lot of good work on the cost of county squads. And 2017, the overall cost of county teams was €25 million, which is up from 18.5 in 2011. We can be sure that that number has risen in the last 2 years.
Yeah.
Is it sustainable, in your opinion?
Well, sustainable, definitely not. But how do you reverse that trend? I mean, there were stories coming out. I'm sure Kev McStay has a book out currently, and in that details, you know, how he had to cover the cost of some travel expenses and hotel expenses for some of his team, and the difficulties with which Roscommon had in terms of fundraising. I think just the issues in and around, like, Mick Foley had a very interesting piece on Sunday last in the Sunday Times, whereby he was just bringing up the point. I think one of the things that maybe got looked over in last week's hullabaloo around the Cork management appointments was the appointment that the county board made of a risk and audit subcommittee, which are four very highly qualified people, basically just to kind of to keep a fairly tight appraisal on in terms of the corporate governance and how much is being spent. And Mick was making the point in his article, which is not an unfair one, that that level of governance is probably something that the GA is going to have to grasp, because you have, but for the most part, and like, all very good people, all working really hard, but all working really in a voluntary capacity, running small little corporations and small little businesses, which is what each of these county boards are. And you now have a situation whereby if you marry that with the runaway train, that is the cost of inter-county expenses and the cost of, you know, the budgets in and around the inter-county scene. I think there's a very difficult conversation to be had there, but putting a cap in terms of the spending is another quagmire that could be very difficult to implement across the board. I'm not entirely sure how they would manage to do it, because I think if you even go back to the situation in and around when Pádraig Duffy wanted to address the issue of payments to managers, and they were saying about the payments under the table, they couldn't even find the table, was the big joke back then, wasn't it? Like that. So if you have that issue in around payments to managers, you know, how do you put a cap on spending? Lads, a team goes away for a weekend, that's picked up by a private benefactor who decides, you know, it's just, I don't know. I mean, it's the spirit of the whole thing that I suppose you have to call into question. And I know that Jarlett Burns has mentioned in his pitch for the presidency that that's part of something that he would like to see happen, is a kind of a state of the union. Where are we? What are we? And what are we looking to achieve over the next 20?
You're almost getting beyond payments managers now. It's the backroom teams, I think, that are eating up a lot of this cash. And I thought Donal Maloney's statement on Sunday saying he's withdrawn from the race to be the solo Clare manager. And he said it was interesting because of the little bit of doubt around it. He said, "I do not wish to inhibit members of the existing management team and persons who had committed to coming on board for 2020 from missing out on opportunities as other counties put their coaching teams together." Adrian, maybe I'm leaping here, but I'm taking that to mean, as much as it means the selectors, it means the people in the backroom teams who are paid, your masseuses, your physios, your S&C coaches, your
nutritionists,
stats people,
video work.
It's beyond the cottage industry. This is a proper industry. These aren't people's full time jobs, but these are very, very lucrative side gigs for people who are probably have their own practices and stuff like that.
Exactly. I have to say that line jumped out at me as well. I didn't realize that this was such a, you know, transfer window this time of year for those people, who makes sense. You'd see it a lot when people are pitching for jobs, that they need to kind of come with a fully formed team almost and sell that kind of unit in. And it's massive at the moment, isn't it? I mean, and then you have the likes of, you know, not to go back to Tipperary, but like I said, Gary Keegan and these really kind of top of their game people who are working behind the scenes as well. So yeah, I mean, it's a big business these days, as you say, and I suppose transparency, going back to your first point, is probably whatever the solution is, that kind of, yeah, openness is probably the first step to whatever the solution might be down the line.
Yeah. Okay. We could talk about this all day, but I think we want to move on to simpler, happier times for the two men in the studio with me here. As I said, Adrian is the editor of the42.ie, but he is also the author of a new book called The Double, How Cork Made GAA History. Adrian has spoken to pretty much everyone who's involved in the Cork senior football and hurling teams. We'll get on to who you talk to in a minute, but Adrian, we're of a similar vintage. I was interested, first of all, how much of this do you remember from the time? What are your memories of this year?
I remember, you know, I was probably 8 years old, so it's kind of, I remember the hype and the excitement and the fun, and it's kind of wrapped up in Italian 90 with me as well. I wasn't at the games. I kind of, you know, I remember stringing bunting out the window, and I remember watching once the final and the All-Ireland final, but that's it really. Like, so a lot of the fun for me was kind of going back and watching those games anew almost, and enjoying them in their own merits really. Like, and yeah, and then you're getting, it was a real treat, like kind of getting the benefit of, you know, a lot of cups of coffee with kind of childhood heroes and hearing their recollections and their perspective on it. So yeah, it was a real labour of love, I suppose. It was great.
I'll ask you the almost unfair question first, because I've read most of the book. I haven't quite got to the end of it yet. But
I won't spoil the ending.
Yeah, I won't spoil the ending. But it's probably a quicker question to ask you. Who did you not speak to? Who could you not get hold of?
Teddy McCarthy is the obvious one. And it's shame, like, so he wasn't particularly available to me, and he is the guy who would be top of the list really, wouldn't he? So he for people who don't know, he won 2 All-Irelands in a fortnight, like, and massive character and personality, I'm really important player really for that whole era. But he's written his own book, and he's as you said, talked to all his teammates, so hopefully his perspective is represented in some way and his voice is in there. Then after that, I suppose the cannon,
yeah,
is the big one. Like,
yeah,
he passed away a few years ago. The hurling coach, and kind of idiosyncratic, hurling fanatic, really. Like, I remember him from my school days. I went to St. Finbar's Fianna Fáil, and he was associated with that school for a long time. He would have been around, so I have memories of the man. But again, I just had to kind of speak to everybody who knew him. So they'd be the kind of the big two, I suppose.
He was seen as a kind of, as you say, idiosyncratic, kind of stern, a little bit kind of, shall we say, irascible.
Yeah.
But in fairness to him, he had a bit about him. He had a lot about him, but in terms of his personality, he knew to surround himself by the right people. And you take an interest in the opening of this book. It opens kind of with Brian Keenan, the 5 years a hostage, just days out. And he goes to the Cork v Galway hurling final. So you take an interest, like, you don't launch straight into players' recollections. But after that, you introduce us to a character who Rory probably knows, but I'd say a lot of people outside Cork have never heard of. Could you tell us who the kid Cronin was?
Yeah, he was a massive personality again behind the scenes. He was from my era, so I remember from my childhood, and from being on coach trips as a young hurler, him at the top singing songs on the rest of it. But he was a professional boxer in England in his younger days. He came back and he was brought in 1973 as the masseuse for that much-loved Cork football team.
Not particularly good masseuse by all accounts.
Well, in his latter days, I think it's fair to say. But I think he knew how to do the job, and he was well able for it for a couple of decades. And then, yeah, as you say, by the time the double came around, he was an old man, he was in his 70s. But I think more than that, he was and people make this point, he was a psychologist and a kind of a yin to the yang, for Billy Morgan and the Cannon. As I say, they were kind of intense characters where he was, a friend really, and a link to between the management, I suppose, and the players. He was a very funny man, I think. He does great stories of his wit, and he loved the game of cards and kind of getting back to Blackpool for a pint after a game or whatever. So as well as that, you're looking for links between the two. It's two stories, really, and you're trying to twin them and kind of tie it together a bit. And he was one of those elements. There was Teddy, Dennis Walsh, Dr. Conn, and Kid, probably, as well as other people, I'm sure, but they were the kind of four. So yeah, and people love talking about him. So it was just a kind of case of, you go to chat to Larry Tompkins, and it's a nice way to start a conversation. What do you remember with the kid? And they're kind of thinking to some mad trip in the Canaries or America or something, and the kid made some hilarious joke or whatever. So and then hopefully he's a touch point throughout the book, and people have mentioned, all right, that he's a good personality throughout it.
Yeah, Rory, this book, I know you've read it, you probably devoured it in about a night.
Yeah, and unlike Adrian, I was actually at both games.
All right, no need to rub it in.
The hurling I went with my dad, and the football I was with the club, Nemo, and I've two distinct memories of that time, like having read the book, and the first one was on the night of the homecoming. I very nearly, like, and I mean this in all sincerity, I was nearly killed. It was the single most scariest experience I think I've ever had. I'm not entirely sure how many people turned out on the streets, but basically it was an open-top bus which came around from the South Mall, sorry, from the Grand Parade around onto the South Mall, and there was such a mass of people. So when the bus turned the corner, these are the days where health and safety, there was, you know, there, you saw the situation in and around the Dublin homecoming and, you know, how sort of, how H&S is all really, you know, very, very important nowadays. There was none of that back then. It was just absolute chaos on the streets. And I just remember for maybe, it might have only been a minute, but I definitely lost control. It was one of those frightening situations whereby you're just being moved along in the crowd. And it was extremely scary. Obviously, I don't know how many people were supposedly on the streets of Cork that night. They're saying it was up to a quarter of a million. I don't really know. Who knows? The second, which was obviously on a much lighter note, was the following morning. My school, we had, the secondary school that I went to had the largest representation across both panels. So we were the first school that the Liam McCarthy and Sam Maguire visited on that Tuesday morning. And we all were herded down into the main hall, as it were, as the same in every school. The two cups are brought in, and all the players, it's kind of a smattering of players across both, you know, Jer Cunningham and Jim Cashman, and, you know, there was a good few of the Nemo lads, Jimmy, you know, but one person that was missing, and he'd only left the school, I think, about three years before, was Stephen O'Brien. Now, Stephen was obviously a bit of a massive hero within the school itself, because I think he would have been very young. Yeah. And he might have only been 20, I'd say, because he kind of broke onto the team at a very, very young age. So everyone was in this, where's Stephen? And next thing, the door is open at the back. There's Stephen O'Brien being chaired almost like, you know, rock concert style, you know, being chaired up onto the stage. And they were special times. And, you know, like, it's unlikely you're ever going to see an achievement like that or a moment like that for any county. I know Offaly came very close, I think, on a couple of occasions, and Galway certainly did. And who knows, that might happen again. I mean, I'm sure Dublin would have ambitions at some stage, maybe trying to repeat it. But they were rare times.
They really were. Adrian, the part I read last night, which is fresh in my mind, is the Meath Cork dynamic, which really was, it became quite poisonous quite quickly. You know, you spoke to a good few people on the Meath side as well. And as you say, it started out quite innocent, but then, you know, a replay where Cork field were robbed the first day, and a replay where Meath decided to take no prisoners in a very quintessentially Meath way. And that was the end of relations, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I suppose we pick up the story, and I decided to pick up the story in 87, when that was Billy Morgan's first year, and it was all about Kerry, you know, and they needed to overcome that kind of monster, really, and they were focused on Kerry, and they did, and it was Meath coming down the tracks, and I don't think they were particularly prepared for that, and Meath were probably, you know, a year or two down the track further than them at that stage, like, and even though, you know, people like Larry Tompkins and Shafi, who had played underage against Meath and knew those players, and even a senior actually did play them through the years, they knew well what they were coming up against. They tried to communicate intellectually what was coming, but they had to actually experience it to realise that this was a different ball game. And then so 88, yeah, as you say, they met in a really fraught final. The first day, Tommy Sugar, who I speak to, was the referee, and he gave a controversial free in the last moment.
He still doesn't see it that way.
Yeah, he put his case across very well, I thought. Like, if it's a free in the first minute, it's free in the last minute. But I suppose the the counter from Cork is that it wasn't free, you know. So, but he maintains it is, and that's fair enough. And then, yeah, as you said, the next day, Billy kind of said, let's just pair it back and play our own ball game, really. Whereas, you know, at the same time, Meade were kind of taking it up a few levels. And, you know, it was a really tough game, to put it mildly, I suppose. The GA president afterwards was kind of lamenting the state of the game and, you know, has this been imported from internet or compromised rules at the time or whatever. And then 89, they didn't meet apart from, didn't meet in the championship, but it was festering. And then they kind of booked into the same apartment complex, essentially, in Gran Canaria, and were sharing a pool and sharing bars, and nobody spoke. Well, there was a few paired off and they'd have conversations. But yeah, it just got silly, really, as is the word that's used, and it got toxic. And then they met in 90, and it kind of helped, I think, the footballers really to focus on the task in hand. Like, I mean, if it was someone else, they might have been concentrating on, you know, achieving the double. But, you know, I suppose modern sports psychologists would just call it the process, or Jim Gavin, you know, it was just a case of, like, let's get over Meade. And then by doing that, they achieved the double or whatever. So it kind of insulated them from that kind of hype that you remember, Rory was, you know, went up massive levels in that fortnight. Like, but they were just such a focused team and group at the time, it helped, I think.
They were getting verbal volleys from all sides, because Mick O'Dwyer, they retired Mick O'Dwyer pretty much, so he's had a newspaper column and he was saying all sorts. And then on the hurling side, of course, you'd Babs, yes, and his famous line, donkeys don't win derbies.
Yeah, which I tried to unravel the myth from the reality, and I don't know if I'm any the wiser. I've put everybody's recollections down on paper, really, if that line was used or not. Some people remember the cannon twisting it, I suppose, or employing it as a kind of motivational tactic. Others are really insistent that he would never use that. And but whatever, the fans really jumped on it. Like, it was, you know, it was something that was used to kind of build the hype of the Cork Tip, you know, because Cork were at a low ebb coming into 98 in hurling terms, and Tipperary were, you know, after that famine ended in 87, they were on top for a couple of years. So that donkeys and derbies thing was really twisted. And yeah, and you say Babs then, he was commentating on the game for UTV at the time, I think, had the rights for the final, so he was up in the galley or whatever as well. And yeah, and Mikko had his column, and he was yeah, quick enough to kind of stitch it into Cork still, I think, looking back on the papers, which was a lot of fun as well for me. And Liam Hayes then was, you know, it wouldn't happen now, I don't think. I can't envisage the likes of us anyway. But, you know, he was a working journalist and yeah, very successful. Like, and so his columns were kind of tacked up a lot as well. Like, so, yeah, there was a lot to go through. It was a lot of fun.
You, as I said, the intro is fantastic. You know, to go in on Brian Keenan is not normal in a sports book. It's obvious the amount of love and attention that went into the writing of it, but I think even more so the research. I know you probably went down a few rabbit holes here or there. You kind of got lost, kind of forgot what you were doing and just got interested in something that may have been a bit of a tangent.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's, if you're taking on a project like this, you kind of have to really get into it, and like, almost get obsessed with it. So, you know, I went through a lot of research, really, as secondary, and as well as talking to a lot of the players who are really generous with their time and their memories, I suppose. But yeah, the Brian Keenan thing, I suppose, like, I kind of wanted to put the story in context, if you know what I mean. And 1990, you know, it was a different country, really. You know, Charlie High is sitting there watching the games. It was his 65th birthday, I think, on the day of the football final. You know, Mary Robinson was sitting behind him. You know, she wasn't yet present, obviously. Nelson Mandela, his coming relief to Ireland, I suppose, yeah, was the same day as the Irish football team's homecoming and the day of the Munster football final. So I wanted to kind of, as I say, kind of put it into place and time. And then Brian Keane's story is really interesting, and he was, again, very generous in his time speaking to me. He came out of Beirut and he picked up a newspaper and realised the hurling was on that weekend, and he asked for tickets, and the GA obliged him, even though essentially the PRO, Danny Lynch, had to give up his seat. And he just found it overwhelming, you know, and I kind of make the point that
sensory overload.
Yeah, he just couldn't handle it. He had to kind of get up from his seat and go back into the suite a few times just to kind of compose himself. And I didn't know where the story would fit in, really, but I just thought his perspective would be interesting. And then it kind of became clear that he articulated a lot of the madness of that hurling final. I think it was, you know, a particularly... Oh, like, there's been a lot of great hurling finals since, but that was a great one. And him being able to articulate how exciting it was better than me, I thought, at the time.
So it's the double. How Cork Made GAA History by Adrian Russell, published by Mercier Press. It's out now in all good, bad and disreputable and reputable bookshops. Go get a copy. It really is. It's a labour of love. It comes across, and it's a really fantastically well-written book and well worth a read. That's our lot. Before we go, customary to mention this week's GAA coverage on RTE. We'll have club updates on the radio on Saturday and Sunday, along with all the other sport, the international soccer, the rugby, on RTE Radio 1 and 2FM. And on RTE 2 on Saturday evening, we have Ballyvoden versus Nafina and Vincent's v St. Jude's. What time is that all thrown in at, Laura?
Yeah, it's a bumper day sport, actually, on Saturday. I think our coverage is starting quite early in the morning for Ireland Samoa. It starts things off. That's then followed by Ireland versus Georgia in soccer, which comes on, that I think we're starting off at about 11 o'clock. That takes us up to about 1:45 when Ireland-Georgia kick in. And then we follow the Ireland-Georgia game at 4:45 with a double header. Our coverage at 4:45. 5:15 then is the throw-in for Jude's against Vincent's. And at 7 o'clock, it's Ballyboden against Nafina.
Oh, these TV lads are going to have to work as hard as us online folk work every day, Adrian. Pity about them, huh? Anyway, thank you very much for listening. This has been the RTGA podcast. I've been Mikey Safford. I've been joined by Rory O'Neill and Adrian Russell. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts if you haven't done so already. And we will chat to you next week. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.